This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Last Thursday, we ended up with me trying to persuade all of you to enter these sessions on Oedipus and your seminar discussions and your own thinking on Oedipus by dispensing, I was arguing, having admitted that I totally deceived you in the first of the two great questions that you all voted on, that you all voted 90-10 for preponderance of free choice in your own personal individual lives. Turn off whatever was just ringing, please. And then I acknowledged that what I want to argue and what I did argue was that I believe that the 5th century Greeks and earlier Greeks and later ancient Greeks, and very particularly Sophocles, in my view, don't want to allow us, either in our own lives or in a text like Oedipus, to say, we experience this play, we feel this play as just being driven by fate or destiny or allotted portion. All those words I have there on the handout, though not on this page. And on the other hand, that we're not meant to be able to say it is just individual choice and initiative and action that happens in our lives either or in this play, that we have to put them in a great, big, messy, confusing, frustrating, migraine-inducing ball of wax along the lines of that pithy saying, character is destiny. Character is fate. You are fated to live a certain way, to engage in certain types of actions, to be a certain type of person because you are who you are. Because you are who you are, you do things a certain way, and you're fated to do them that way because that's who you are. That's what I am hoping and pleading that you may all be willing to take on and try out. Now, I want us to look first today, well, just for a minute or two, just to get us back into the verge of the text of the play itself. I just want to point out two or three things at this point, at this part of the second page of the handout. I want to make sure that every person in this room and all absentees will never make the mistake, or at least make the mistake again, of thinking or saying or accepting from anyone else without an aggressive challenge in their face that on the one hand we have, out of 7 surviving Sophoclean plays, that we have 3 that deal with the story of the Oedipus family. That's, of course, absolutely right. They're all in our volume. Oedipus the King, Oedipus at Colonus, and Antigone. That's fine, but what is totally meretricious, if you can spell that, is the thought that these are connected. That Sophocles composed what is often referred to absolutely fraudulently as a Theban trilogy, an Oedipus trilogy. That they were composed to be performed on a single day together in sequence. Totally false. These are 3 chronologically very disparate Sophoclean explorations of problems in the family of Oedipus of Thebes. Antigone is the earliest chronologically. Oedipus the King, our play, is in the middle, early in the Peloponnesian War. And Oedipus at Colonus is the very latest, in fact, not even performed until after Sophocles had died. So a posthumous production for Oedipus at Colonus. Each of these plays stands on its own. As we'll see more in just a few minutes, they were performed with other tragedies, but they weren't performed with one another. Do not ever again let any of your friends or any adult figure, any figure of authority say to you, now in Sophocles' Oedipus trilogy, you go up and just put your fist right in their face and say, McCall made me do it, that's my fate. And of course, our play goes by any of these three titles. Oedipus the King in English, Oedipus Rex in Latin, Oedipus Tyrannos in Greek. We don't know exactly when it was put on. Sometime early in the Peloponnesian War, the dates of which are at the bottom of the preceding page. And extremely important to know, is that almost at the beginning, just a few months, half a year after the Peloponnesian War began, a great plague swept through Athens. Memorably described in the pages of the great historian Thucydides. Athens was decimated. One of the victims of the plague was the great man himself, Pericles, who had been the numero uno citizen, soldier, statesman of Athens for a full generation. He succumbed to the plague in 430 BC. A few years later, we don't know exactly how much later, but not very much later, our playwright, Sophocles, puts on, in a given dramatic festival, among other tragedies that he presents in that particular festival, this play, Oedipus the King. And, of course, as all of you are fully aware, the play, the plot of the play, the driving force in the play is plague, pestilence, sickness resting on the city of Thebes. And it is Oedipus's mission to save his city, in the course of which, as you all know, Oedipus is brought very low. In some sense, though we have to explore before the end of Thursday in exactly what sense or in how complete a sense Oedipus is defeated, ruined, overcome, overwhelmed by the sickness in his city. He starts off at the height of his power. He ends up blind and out of the kingship. He doesn't die. He doesn't die for quite a few years, in fact. He wanders after the play ends throughout the Greek world as a blind outcast, and he dies the moment the hour of his death is explored and presented in Oedipus at Colonus. It is impossible, in my view, not to connect at some level, at some unknown degree of specificity, our figure, our dramatic figure of Oedipus, and the real life figure of Pericles. Athens loses Pericles. Thebes loses Oedipus. Sickness brings down Pericles. Sickness, in a complex way, brings down Oedipus. All right. Now that's as far as I want to go there, except to point out now, can't be held a secret, all through his life, Sophocles was inordinately successful. He was a prolific play producer, and almost every time he competed in the festival that we're going to be learning something about in a few minutes, he won. He may have appeared in the competitive lists, oh, perhaps 30 times over about a 60-year career, approximately every other year, and he may have won first prize 20 times or 25 times. We're not quite sure. There were three playwrights competing. They got first prize, second prize, third prize. Sophocles never, ever in his 60-year career had to settle for a third place finish. And if we had the chance in this course to read a tragedy of Euripides and learn something about Euripides, we would be finding out that Sophocles' younger contemporary, Euripides, hardly ever won a first prize and had to settle for third prize again and again and again and again. For instance, with that unforgettable play that I'm sure a lot of you have read, Medea. But with our play, Oedipus, arguably the most famous play of all time, even including Hamlet, Sophocles won on that day of competition or in that festival of competition only second place. And no one has ever been able to explain that. Perhaps the great Professor Evans will take it upon himself to explain that. Now, I want to, just let me pause there a second. Just on the basis of that big sermon I gave last time and kind of summarized right now, is there anything anybody wants to pin me to the wall on or say, do us a favor and trip over some more wires or whatever, just before I proceed to fatal flaw? Fantastic, fantastic. I'm going to interpret that as saying, you're all with me. You're my guys and gals. I don't know what to call you. Anyhow, you're my friends. All right. Now, I want a moment of truth and confession from a whole lot of you. I want to know, and this is serious, I want to see a bunch of hands up in the air, and if you don't put your hands up in the air, I'll know that you're lying. I want to know how many of you who studied Oedipus somewhere in your high school careers, how many of you were brought into the presence of a theory to explain and solve Oedipus and even potentially all tragedy, namely the theory of the fatal flaw, the tragic error. For how many of you is that a familiar ingredient in discussing Oedipus and tragedy? Oh, my friends, you are an honest crowd. All right. By the time Professor Evans and I are finished with you in early December, you'll know how to deceive with the best of us. I promise you that. But not now. You're innocent and fresh and honest. Oh, I love it. All right. Now I want to tell you, and now for about 10 minutes or so, you have to pay even closer attention because we're now embarking on a very tough, scholarly, monstrous controversy and debate. You have to know, you probably do know, that the theory of the fatal flaw, the tragic error, to explain the play Oedipus, potentially to explain tragic drama or tragedy in whatever genre, comes from Aristotle, comes from Aristotle's Poetics. I'm holding up two different translations of Aristotle's Poetics. Aristotle's Poetics was written as in about 330 BC, so almost exactly a century later than our play, and more or less a century after the surviving Greek tragedies, which all come from the 5th century BC. And Aristotle's Poetics was written at his school, his school, which was a rival to Plato's Academy. Once Aristotle founded it in the latter part of the 4th century, the Lyceum, and the Poetics was written as a kind of graduate seminar, a book of detailed notes as a graduate seminar. So it's very terse, elliptical. You have to supply context and meaning everywhere. In chapter 13 of Aristotle's Poetics, Aristotle has gotten to the point of examining and stating what he thinks to be the best kind of tragedy. I'm just going to read part of what he says. Since the construction of the finest tragedy should not be simple but complex, and moreover, it should represent terrifying and pitiable events. Now that refers to another of Aristotle's famous dicta in the Poetics, namely that the force of tragedy depends essentially on eliciting from us, the audience, the emotions of pity and fear. You've also all heard that. That's absolutely right. I mean, that's true to what Aristotle says elsewhere in the Poetics. Moreover, it should represent terrifying and pitiable events. Since that's so, first, clearly, it should not show decent men undergoing a change from good fortune to misfortune, for this is neither terrifying nor pitiable, but shocking. Nor should it show wicked men passing from misfortune to good fortune. This is most untragic of all, as it has nothing of what it should. Nor, again, should it show a thoroughly villainous person falling from good fortune into misfortune. Such a structure can contain moral satisfaction, but not pity or terror. There remains, then, the person intermediate between these. Such a person is one who neither is superior to us in virtue and justice, nor undergoes a change to misfortune because of vice and wickedness, but because of some error, and who is one of those people with a great reputation and good fortune, e.g., Oedipus, Thyestes, and distinguished men from similar families. All scholars agree that in the reference to Oedipus, Aristotle is almost guaranteed to be referring to our play. Now, you'll notice that this particular translator that I just read uses the word error. Now you have to learn your next Greek term, and you have to use it. Hamartia. Hamartia. That's the word that Aristotle uses. Just to make sure everybody's still awake, let me hear it. Hamartia. Hamartia. Oh, you're a bunch of mealy mouths. Come on. Hamartia. All right, all right, all right. This word in Greek has its root meaning, the meaning miss the mark. This is a noun, hamartia, but it comes from a verb, and the verb, which is very old. You find it everywhere in Homer, for instance, and if you use the first person singular, it means I miss the mark. It comes from a military context. You throw a spear, you don't kill your opponent, I miss the mark. As you can see, in its root meaning, it has no moral or ethical overlay. You simply make a mistake. You're trying to kill somebody, you don't succeed. No moral censure at all, you've just missed the mark. If you were to put together, which of course scholars have done, the hundreds of instances in surviving Greek texts down to Aristotle's Poetics toward the end of the 4th century BC, in which the noun or the verb appear, and look at their contexts, you would find that huge numbers of usages of hamartia or its cognate verb remain being used in this neutral, morally neutral sense. I made a mistake. He made a mistake. He didn't hit the mark. You would also find, as the usage goes through the decades and centuries between Homer and Aristotle, that there are a lot of passages where a moral level, a moral element, has come into the semantic range of that term. So by the time of the 5th century, for instance, and certainly by the time of Aristotle's Poetics, hamartia can mean and does mean, depending on its context, either a mistake, an error, not morally burdened, or it can mean a mistake, an error that has a moral, ethical dimension to it, a wrongful, morally corrupt mistake. Now, my friends, the problem, the unsolvable problem in the Greek passage that is the source of all theories over all the ages of the fatal flaw. The fatal flaw and the tragic error are just particular translations of this term in this Aristotelian passage. And the horrible problem is that we don't know. No scholar can demonstrate, and you can't demonstrate, and I can't demonstrate, whether Aristotle, in describing what he regards as the best type of central figure in tragedy, notice he never uses the word hero. That's kind of our term to describe these big figures in Greek tragedy. He uses just big figure or person or important person from distinguished families. It's impossible to know whether Aristotle means to have a moral, ethical dimension to the way he's describing what brings down this kind of big figure who's not perfect, but is rather better than worse, or whether he doesn't mean to have a moral dimension. Since about the 16th century or so, the vast majority of commentators on Aristotle's Poetics have taken the option of saying, of interpreting Aristotle's Poetics, this famous, famous passage, which is the source of it all, of interpreting this passage as indeed using hamartia in a moral way. And therefore, in English, such phrases that we've all grown up with as fatal flaw and tragic error have come to dominate the discussion of what Aristotle's theory of the best kind of tragedy and the best kind of central figure should be interpreted to mean. And my sad but necessary message to you is, you've got to throw that out the window. You cannot any longer, for the rest of your lives, with your peers, your teachers, the outside educated world, you cannot say, and again, you cannot allow anyone else to say, well, we all know about the tragic flaw, the fatal flaw, the tragic error. In fact, some of us know that it comes from Aristotle's Poetics. And all you have to do is plop it onto the grid of Oedipus the King or some other tragedy, whether Greek or perhaps Shakespearean, and you have the key to that tragedy or all those tragedies. You can't do it. Or rather, you can do it if this is your own individual analytical assessment of how best to get inside our tragic texts. But what you can't do is say, oh yes, fatal flaw, tragic error, they've long been established. There's no questioning that. And in fact, they go right back to a particular passage in Aristotle's Poetics. They do not. Or at least it will never be able to be proven whether they do or not. So I want to insist that you have to approach our play, and I would say also Hamlet, but I'll leave all wise things on Hamlet to Professor Evans, but certainly for Oedipus, you have to approach this play, I believe, with a clean slate. And going back again to that marvelous lecture class on the humanities that Professor Evans gave us, you have to let the text speak to you. You can't impose some theory such as this one, which can't even be established historically, except as a possibility. All right, now that was pretty vicious. I want to pause for another moment here and see if there's someone who wants to say, but, oh, beloved Professor McCall, you're full of it because, or some such statement. All right, now I'm going to have the high pleasure of sitting in on several seminars this week, and perhaps I'll see you tear this down or go back to this theory of the tragic error, the fatal flaw, but I hope I hear you discussing it, as it were, because of your own assessment, not because it's received truth that you have to take on. All right, now, at this point, still time for anyone to say, I don't believe any of that because, or, of course, it's also time for anyone to say, Professor McCall, that made me decide to become a classicist for the rest of my life. You know, you could also say that. Well, I don't see volunteers on either side. I'm going to call you morally neutral. All right, now we're going to have about 10 minutes of slides. And, Davey, do you think this is dark enough? I mean, I want people to be able to take notes. What do you think?
Fine.
All right. Would people maybe, sort of slouch down in your chairs if you can figure out that your head is one of those. Okay. I don't know. All right. There went one head. Well, that went all right. I think that's pretty good. I think that's pretty good. All right. Well, there's still some. Glop out there is not, that doesn't matter. We're not going to be, there it goes. All right. So here we are. Here's Athens. Up here is Delphi, where Oedipus goes to seek the oracle. Down here is Corinth, where, as you all know, Oedipus is totally, 100%, absolutely convinced that's where he's from. That's where his parents are. Down in Corinth, that's where he was raised as the son of the king and queen of Corinth. Thebes is right about there. So actually closer to Delphi, right about there. So it's not on this map, but that's where we are in the play. All right, next slide, please. And Davey, you can just focus all the way along as best you can. So now what I want us to do is to get a brief sense, but I hope a vivid sense, of what it was like to be in the ancient theater in the 5th century BC watching one of these Athenian tragoidii at their original production day. Where we are is over on a side of the Acropolis, right down in there. That's where the theater of Dionysus is. Dionysus is the god of tragedy and of comedy. Let's have the next slide, Davey. Here we are up on at the walls. Here are the walls of the Acropolis, and we're looking right down on the remains, the archaeological remains of the theater of Dionysus. So here is our god, Dionysus, and the festival, the principal festival every year in Athens where dramatic competitions, both of tragedy and comedy, and in fact other poetic competitions took place, is called the Festival of the Great Dionysia, the great festival for the god Dionysus. It took place in a whole sanctuary here. Part of the sanctuary was the theater of Dionysus, but it's extremely important to know from the beginning that the theater of Dionysus, and therefore all performances of tragedy and comedy, were done in a religious sanctuary at a religious festival. And the festival took place about mid-March or so. Now you may think that, all right, this is fine, but okay, tell me something more, McCall, and I will. You can bet on that. You will never forget, I promise you, you will never forget when the annual festival of the Great Dionysia and the production of plays like Oedipus occurred, because, my friends, they occurred almost exactly every year at the time of your professor's birthday. The middle of next March, you may think you will have forgotten me long since, but about the middle of next March, in fact, March 11th, take it down, March 11th, as you're preparing the cookies and cakes and pies that you're just going to send to me, you can say very truthfully to yourselves, I'm doing this not just for McCall, but in order to honor the god Dionysus, the god of tragedy, on the occasion of the celebration of his annual festival, the Great Dionysia. Isn't that terrific? And when you do that, you're going to imagine yourselves in this very scene. I want to feel the excitement palpable in this room, because you are looking at the space where Western drama originated. This is where it happened. Virtually all the plays, not just the surviving plays, but all the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and all the scores and scores of now lost tragedians and comic playwrights, the original performances were right here. And you can go to it. I'm sure there are a handful of you who actually have walked through the Theater of Dionysus in Athens, and I hope all of you will in the near future. So, around mid-March or so, there was about a five-day period, one of many, many festivals in the Athenian calendar year, where more or less everything stopped, and thousands of people came every day, along with initial big civic processions and final big civic processions. It was sort of like July 4th, Memorial Day, a big operatic festival, all rolled into one. This theater You wouldn't believe it from this shot and this photo and what remains. This theater is huge and sat about 17,000 people. 17,000 people. Now you have to reckon that the population of Athens, the male citizen population of Athens in the middle of the 5th century was something like the population of Palo Alto, something like 60,000 or so. Then, of course, you have to add another 150,000 or so of the people who didn't count in 5th century Greek society, the women and the slaves, and to some extent, the children. So the audience here, you'll remember from the overhead that was first up there, the next thing on the line would have been audience. Let's just go to the next slide, Davey. This is a side shot, so there are the walls of the Acropolis up there. Here's the steep hillside, but a natural curved hillside. This is true of all Greek theaters, and it helps a lot to explain the wonderful acoustics in all Greek theaters. All right, so 15, 16, 17,000 people here for a given dramatic performance. Three playwrights were chosen each year to compete for first, second, and third prizes. They each put on, they had a day of drama to themselves. So on our day for Oedipus the King, Sophocles had it all to himself and he put on three tragedies. And then at the end of the day, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, something like that, it probably began 8 o'clock or so. At the end of the day, there was a fourth play called a satyr play, S-A-T-Y-R, a satyr play, where the chorus was always costumed phallically as satyrs. And it was a kind of a mock drama on some kind of heroic story. So there were 3 days, 3 competing tragic poets. There was 1 day for competing comic poets. They just put on one comedy each. And then a small group of citizen judges ruled on the tragedies and on the comedies. First prize, second prize, third prize. There were 10 citizen judges who voted. And this is a wonderful system. We ought to consider it in this country. After those 10 votes were made, first prize, second prize, third prize, 5 of the votes were thrown out so that if anyone was trying to bribe the citizen judges, you would know in advance a lot of your money would be wasted because 50% of the voting citizens didn't even have their votes count in the end. Isn't that great? All right, now there's just one other thing I want to say here. And that also has to do with the audience. There are 2 things I want to say here. Number one, I just have to tell you that for the opening day performance of Oedipus the King, somewhere in the early 420s, we just do not know whether there were any women in the audience. This is yet another of the raging, ongoing controversies in classical scholarship. We know that at some point, women started to be allowed in the theater, though it's absolutely certain that once they were allowed in, they got the peanut gallery seats up there, along with probably children and slaves. Everything else was reserved for male citizens. And just from the figures I've given you, you can reckon that something like 25% or so of all Athenian male citizens were likely to be in the theater on a given day of dramatic performance. What a civic cultural event. There's no parallel that I'm aware of anywhere close to it in our society. So huge thousands of male citizens, certain number of foreign visitors, maybe, but maybe not at the time of our play, some women, overwhelmingly male. And all the playwrights were male. All the actors were male. A male actor played Jocasta, for instance. A male actor plays Medea and Clytemnestra and Phaedra and Helen, all the other great, powerful females that populate Greek tragedy. And in the seating, all those wedges look just like old Stanford Stadium. It wasn't first come, first sit down. You went and you sat with your community, with your neighborhood. So it's as though this was for Branner, and that for Flomo, and over here is for Robley, and on around the block. But the central wedge, I'm just going to guess from this angle, I'll call that one the central wedge. The central wedge, my friends, was reserved for one particular kind of theater going. It was reserved for you. And by you, I mean the male young men in this room, the 18 and 19-year-olds. In Athens, they had a particular name to them. They were called the Ephebs. The Ephebs, and they are the future of the city. So this is all neighborhood seating, but the actors, the chorus, the whole play, in a real dramatic sense, is aiming toward you, the Ephebs, the future of the city. So Athenian tragedy is poetry in action, it's spectacle, it's ceremony, it is also a didactic cry to the male citizens of the city, this is what we want you to be thinking about. And above all, dead center, this is what we want the young men of the city to be inculcating into themselves. All right, next slide, Davey. All right, this is just from a vase painting showing an actor getting dressed actually in a female costume. A male actor is going to eventually become a female character. Here's the mask that he's going to put on. All characters were masked. All right, go on. And here, I just want to show two other theaters. I should have pointed out on the initial map where this one is, not far from Corinth. It's the best preserved of all the ancient theaters in a town called Epidauros, or in modern Greek, Epidavros. Looks twice as big as the Theater of Dionysus in Athens. Actually, it's a few thousand capacity smaller, 14,000, 15,000. There's a summer dramatic festival now every year. And next slide. And my friends, look at that nice woman in the orange. When all of you go to the Theater Epidaurus, here at the very center is what's called the sweet spot. Get everybody, all the thousands of people there, to shut up. Send some docile friend, this is sort of a Tom Sawyer routine, up to the top on some sweltering Greek summer day. And then when your friend is up here and there's no noise anywhere else, then you, standing right there, talk like this. Clyde, can you hear me back there? No, Clyde can't hear me. No. Clyde can't hear me, Davey can hardly hear me, but I promise you that if you stand there and get all the hateful tourists like you to shut up, that your friend up here will hear you perfectly talking exactly like this. Isn't that fantastic? All right, and I think the final slide, we're not quite through yet, I've got a final piece of yelling to do. All right, now this is just another theater, a much smaller one than either in Athens or at Epidauros. It's at Delphi. This is the theater at Delphi here. Only seats about 6,000 or so. But here, much more importantly for us, this is the remains of the Temple of Apollo. This right there is where the Delphic Oracle was. And this is where, in legend, in our story, young Oedipus comes to ask the question of the oracle, who am I, right? He's been in Corinth at a banquet. He's been called quite literally a bastard by someone who I am sure is some frat guy from Cal. Oedipus thinks of killing him, decides not to kill him, but to go to the oracle and ask who he is. And the oracle says, horrifically, you will kill your father and marry your mother. when commit incest with your mother. When Oedipus staggers out of the temple, he has two choices. This is where we're ending 30 seconds. He has two choices. Either he can go back down to the water of the Gulf of Corinth, which is down there someplace, get back on the ship that he came on, go back to Corinth. That's his home. Or he can do what he chooses to do. He can get on the road. It's now a modern road. Look at the tourist bus there. But it's also a very, very ancient road. He can go on the road that goes around the mountain at Delphi, away from his home, in order to seek to avoid the fate that Apollo has thrown out at him. And about 15 or 20 miles around the mountain, he comes to what? What do you think he comes to? A crossroads. And at the crossroads, as Oedipus is walking along, coming the other way, is a chariot with a royal figure inside. That royal figure and his entourage, at the command of the royal figure, who is somewhat older than young Oedipus, the command is, push that traveler out of the road. What you don't do to a warrior prince in Greek tragedy or in Homeric epic, you don't push them out of the road. Murderous havoc will result, and it does. Oedipus kills everybody he can, except for one who escapes. He proceeds to Thebes, and glory be, he gets the hand of the newly widowed queen. 20 years later, our play begins, and that's where we'll start off on Thursday. Thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.